All right, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 26. We're in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we're with the disciples. Remember, we covered the disciples last week. This week, we're going to cover Jesus, his prayer, and then we're going to leave the garden and go out into the trials and denials, I call them here, the betrayal, the denials, and the trials of the disciples, and then as Jesus goes through. So let's go ahead and open up here. Let's just look at where we left off here with the disciples. And we left it with this fact. We're not going to go and relook at all the sections there. If they were operating in faith, they would have stayed there and watched with Jesus, watched in the sense of staying awake so that they could pray and be strengthened together with him. Jesus is going to leave the garden and he's going to be strengthened. He's going to be strengthened spiritually, and that's going to result in him being strengthened physically, emotionally, and mentally. And that's all going to come together. We'll see, that's how Jesus is going to leave. But the disciples are going to go in and they fall asleep. And remember the reason why. They are spiritually asleep before they get to the garden. Jesus keeps telling them things and they say, no, that's not going to happen. He tells them that they are going to, that he's got to go to the cross, die on the cross, and he'll be raised again the third day. And what does Peter say? He says, no way, Lord, not on my watch. He just tells them in the minutes before they get to the garden that they're going to be offended by him. And what does Peter and the 12 say, or the 11 at this point? No way, not on my watch. They say he's going to be denied by him. And they say, no way, on my watch. They've replaced God's things, Jesus's words and God's things, with their own words and the things of men. And Matthew makes this perfectly explicit in Matthew 16, where he says they're savoring the things of men, not the things of God. And whenever you do that, the result is going to be despair and defeat. Because I got a little surprise. Most of us are at a little more advanced in age than others, and I'm pretty sure we all know that if we've gotten this far in our lives, our plans don't really go very far. Our plans are all going to fall apart. Someone asked, after Rockefeller, at the time, I think the richest man in the world, someone asked at his funeral, how much money did he leave behind? All those plans he came up, all those schemes, piling up all that money, and they said, and what's the answer? He left it all behind. And that's what we're all going to do. All our plans, all our schemes really come to nothing. That's why Romans 1 says that it's vanity. It's just the vain imaginations. Eventually, it's all going to come to nothing. Our plans and purposes are all going to come to nothing. The only one whose plan and purpose is going to come to something is God's. And that's what these disciples need to learn. That's what we need to learn. They go into the garden. They've thrown away Jesus' words. They've entered into spiritual slumber. They've left God's plan and are trying to enforce their own plan. And it's going to fail. It's all going to fall apart. That's going to cause them to despair. It's going to cause them to be exhausted mentally, psychologically, emotionally, and physically. But the contrast of this is Jesus, we're going to see in a minute, he leaves this garden and he's spiritually alive. He's communed with the Father. He knows the Father's will. He's committed to it. He's going to go and do it. He sees it's going to fulfill the words of the Father. He's going to put it into motion and get to work. And he leaves the garden emotionally, mentally, physically empowered and strengthened. They are going to leave it weakened. They don't take advantage of this prayer to talk to God about not being brought into temptation. The Lord's Prayer, traditionally called the Lord's Prayer over in Matthew 6, that's what they should have been praying. That's what they should have been talking to God about. They had a ton of things to talk to God about. They could have talked about Christ's death and resurrection. They could have been talking about that instead of denying it. They should have been embracing it and looking forward to that resurrection. They could have been talking to the Father about that. They could have been talking to the Father about Jesus' previous words, that they would be offended by him and that they would deny him. They could have been talking to the Father about that. and they would have been strengthened. They could have been talking to the Father about all kinds of things. They should have been talking to the Father about Satan's policy plan against them and praying for strengthening and things that Jesus had been talking about all the way back to the Sermon on the Mount. And instead, they fall asleep. They first fall spiritually asleep by rejecting Jesus' words to them and God's plan, replacing it with their own words and the plan of men. See, Peter and the 11 at this point, they weren't looking for a Messiah who goes to the dies on a Roman cross in shame. They were looking for a Messiah who'd come in power and glory and destroy the Gentile realm. Now, Jesus said he's going to do that in the future, but this time, right now, the plan, the Father's plan, requires he goes to the cross. And they rejected that, fall into spiritual slumber, and become weakened, and they're going to faint. As it says in Luke 18:1, they're going to faint in their faithfulness because they're going to despair. They've replaced God's plan with their plan, and their plan is falling apart. And they're despairing. They think it's a defeat. If they were in line with God and Jesus' words and God's plan, they would have realized the cross isn't something to despair over. It's full of hope, and because there's the resurrection after, and that's a victory. It's not. If they were in line with God, they would have been strengthened, realizing that this is a full of hope, and this is a victory. Instead, they replaced it with their own plans. Their own plans are going to come to nothing, and all they think of it as despair and defeat. And so they're going to go away weakened. And thus, the title of this section, it's going to interweave after this between the trials of the faithful Jesus at the hands of his enemies and the denials of his disciples as they go through, and the unfaithful servants as we go through here. All right, so that's all more we're going to say about the disciples. We went in more detail last week, but let's look at Jesus's prayer here now. Let's go ahead and pick that up at verse 39. First, it's important to realize he was sorrowful too. Look at verse 37. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee. This is Matthew 26, verse 37. And began to be sorrowful and very heavy, and then said, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death." So he is sorrowful too, but his sorrowfulness isn't out of despair and defeat. His sorrow is coming from looking ahead now and to that cup of wrath he's going to have to participate in, that cup that's going to culminate in him crying from that cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Something's going to happen on that cross where God himself is going to have to turn away. And that's that cup of wrath. And he's looking out to that, and he's going to pray about that now. So let's pick that up in verse 39. He's going to say, "And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." So let's just bring out a couple things here. Mark adds a nice detail. He says that he actually used that Abba phrase. Remember from our Roman study, Abba is not, you know, some of the devotional commentaries, they kind of give you the impression that's kind of baby talk, na-na, pa-pa, mama, and that's an endearing turn of a little child to their parents, but that's not what it is in these accounts. This is a sonship position title. This is an adult son and daughter out of respect and belovingness referring to the Father. This is an adult son and daughter who knows what's going on in the Father's business and who loves the Father and appreciates the Father and respects the Father as an adult son. This isn't baby talk. This is adult son looking to the Father. And he's addressing the Father. He wants to know what's the Father's will. He's going to verify the Father's will as we go down through here. It's the intimacy of the relationship between the Father and the Son as adults The Son as an adult participant in the Father's business, understanding the Father's things and taking all those things into account and obeying the Father. That's the great privilege we have. We read that in Romans 8, right? We can cry out, Abba, Father, because He's brought us. He didn't bring us into His family as little children. He brought us into His family as adult sons and daughters, and He wants to include us in the Father's business. Well, Jesus is doing the same thing here. He's the Son of God, and He's the Son of Man as well, and He's looking to the Father for the Father's will. Abba, Father, beloved Father, whatever you say, I'll do. Your business is the best business. Your information is the only information I need to know. You're what I need to go by. And I'm just wanting, and He's verifying this cup of wrath that's going to culminate in, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Is that something that can be taken away? He's not talking about His death here. He's talking about that cup of wrath, which, of course, ends in His death. But there's a cup of wrath before you get to the death on that cross. So He's being exceedingly sorrowful and very heavy. We just read that three times. He talks about this cup of wrath might pass from Him. And this is not an escape from going to the cross. He willingly was doing that. We've read that all the way back to Matthew 4, Matthew 16. He's been talking about this. Hebrews 12:2 tells us, for the joy set before Him, He endured the cross. It was needed if Israel and indeed the whole world were to be redeemed from sin and death and return to God and His glory, restore His glory on earth. He's not shrinking away from that. He wants to know about something in specific, this cup of wrath that's going to be poured out upon Him. This cup is what He's asking about here. The cup here is the cup of God's wrath, fury and judgment that would be poured out on Him as the sin bearer of Israel and the world. Remember, He's talking here about dying for His friends. He's dying for the nation of Israel. If you want to know how He died for all humans, going all the way back to the fall of Adam, you have to go to Paul for that. Paul explains that. Here He's talking about His death in relationship to the nation of Israel, going all the way back to the 1500 years and those courses of punishment and the curses of the law. Remember in those courses of punishment, He talked about every course of punishment, the wrath got stronger and stronger. I'm going to set my face against you. I'm going to turn away from you. I'm going to walk contrary to you. I'm going to walk contrary to you in fury. And the nation of Israel rejected it, didn't respond out of faith, and grew more rebellious, more unbelief, went further and further away from God. All that wrath, all that judgment, remember every breakage of the law called for an associated punishment. And the punishment was usually death. All that, those curses of the law, all those courses of punishment, all that sin, all that death, breaking of the law, God's going to take that whole thing, 1,500 years altogether, and put it on Christ on that cross. And He's going to be there, Israel's sin bearer. Of course, now through Paul, he knows he was the whole world's sin bearer. But on that cross, he's here, Matthew's talking about the sin bearer for Israel, and he's going to, in that position, he's going to bear all that, and he's sorrowful, this cup of wrath that's set before him. Let's look over, flip back a couple pages to Matthew 20. Matthew 20, he's talked about this cup before. Again, in the context of the disciples not listening to Jesus, basically denying what He says. Chapter 20, Matthew 20, verse 22. And we're just going to pick it up. We're not going to go back to the context, but let's just read these verses. But Jesus answered and said, "You know not what you ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And listen to what they say into here. We are able. They're not even going to be able to withstand a question from a maiden in the courtyard. And they're claiming they can take this drink from this cup of wrath that Christ is going to drink from. And the baptism refers to the death, that baptism into death that he's going to suffer on that cross. Look over let's read verse 23. And he said unto them, "Ye shall drink indeed of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them who are prepared for." So he answers their question there. That's that cup of wrath. Let's go to Isaiah 51. And let's look at this wrath again that's been piling up for the nation of Israel and these courses of punishment under the curses of the law. Isaiah 51, verse 17. He's going to talk about the restoration of Israel. And he says in verse 17, "Awake." This is Isaiah 51, verse 17. "Awake, awake. Stand up, O Jerusalem, which is drunk at the hand of the Lord, the cup of his fury." That takes us right back to what I was talking about earlier in Leviticus 26. "Thou hast drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out." All those courses of punishment, all those curses of the law, all that fury, all that wrath is now going to be placed on the Lord Jesus Christ. And he asks in the garden, is this the cup, this cup that's going to end in him crying out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Can that pass? And let's go back to Matthew 26. He's going to leave now. Oops. He's going to leave now, and they're not going to be able to remove that cup. He's not going to be able to remove that cup. So he's going to verify the will of the Father. And his true sonship obedience, he will submit to the will of the Father. Notice what happens here. We go back to Matthew 26, how the prayer changes as you go from the first time to the second time. The first time he says in verse 39, "O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." But now look at the second time over in verse 42. He went away again a second time and prayed, saying, "O my Father, if this cup may not pass from me." Something happens between the first prayer and the second prayer. In the first prayer, he says, "Can this cup pass from me?" In the second prayer, he acknowledges that since this cup can't pass from me, I'm going to do your will. Something happens between the first prayer and the second prayer. And I would suggest that that's explained in Luke 22:43. Let's just go over there. What could have happened between those two prayers? How did he come to the realization that the cup could not pass? Go to Luke 22, verse 43. Because someone comes on the scene here. Luke 22, and I guess we'll begin in verse 42, it's the same Garden of Gethsemane scene. He goes, he's going to pray. He tells the disciples, "Pray so you don't enter temptation." Verse 41, he says, "And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast and kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine." That's what we just read in Matthew. Verse 43, "And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him." So this is what the disciples should have done. They should have stayed awake and prayed, and the God would have strengthened them. He may not have sent an angel to them. He may have sent an angel, but certainly Jesus, who is strengthened by the angel, would come out and strengthen the disciples if they were praying and watching with him. Instead, they fall asleep and were weakened and are going to fall into temptation. Jesus, the faithful servant, prays, watches and prays to the Father, verifying his will in their sonship position. He's going to do what the Father says. He's going to participate in the Father's business. He's going to carry out the Father's will. And he verifies, is this cup something I really need to drink from? The cup of wrath that's going to culminate in, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And then the second prayer in Matthew, he realizes that he does have to drink from it. And I'd suggest what happened in between there is this angel showed up and began strengthening him. And what might this angel have been strengthening him with? He might have been strengthening him in various ways. I would suggest just looking ahead to especially the important things that are through this account and at the resurrection. He would have perhaps been strengthening him by encouraging him with the words in the law, the prophets, and the Psalms so that all things would be fulfilled. Now, if you're an adult son who appreciates the beloved father and is a willing participant in his things, to be told you're going to do everything the father's been talking about in all the Old Testament scriptures, you're going to fulfill them. See, that would be a great encouragement. And you're going to see through this, through the whole passage, over and over it says, Jesus is going to say that the scriptures be fulfilled, that his father's words be fulfilled. Jesus gave his disciples words and they said, no, you're not going to fulfill those words. Jesus goes to his father and he says, yes, I'm going to fulfill your words. I'm going to do your will. I'm the adult son who's involved in the Father's business. Thou will, your will, not my will. Perhaps the angel was talking to him about the future resurrection, a guarantee of the resurrection in 3 days. And there's all kinds of things he could have been talking about here with regard to this, the joy set before him in the resurrection. He could have been talking about all those promises fulfilled. Hebrews talks about this, the joy set before him. He's going to be seated at the right hand of the Father. He's going to fulfill through that cross all the covenants for the nation of Israel so that Israel can be turned into that nation God designed her to be through that new covenant, the Davidic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant that will end up in Israel restored and the kingdom of God on earth that puts on display his glory throughout the whole earth. Maybe the angel was strengthening him with that. That's what was ahead for him. That cross would just, he's something to be endured, and there's so much victory that's going to come out of that cross and the following resurrection. Not to mention, there's a defeat of Satan. So I think he had a lot of things to be strengthened over, and if the disciples, the point I think that really comes out in this passage, if the disciples were savoring the things of God instead of the things of men, they could have been strengthened exactly like this. But they didn't. Satan has continually attacked Jesus all the way through, and he's going to attack that believing remnant headed up by Peter and the rest. Satan is going to attack them, and he's going to, from the very beginning, all the way back in Matthew 4 with the wilderness temptations, he was trying to get Jesus to go a different route than the cross. Hey, Jesus, you just bow down and worship me, and I'll give you the whole world. I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth. You don't have to go to that cross. You don't have to endure the cross. You don't have to drink of any cup of wrath. You don't have to do any of that. Just bow down, worship me, and I'll just give it to y'all. What does Jesus say? Satan, get away from me. He has to go to the cross. Peter comes along after Jesus tells him, I've got to go to the cross, and I'll be raised again on the third day. And Peter, what does Peter say? Not on my, not while I'm around God or Jesus. It's not going to happen. Not on my reign here. No way are you going to that cross. No. And what does Jesus say to Peter? Get thee behind me, Satan. Everyone's trying to get him. Satan's main plan of attack is get the kingdoms of the earth some other way than the Father's way. And now Jesus is at the end of the line here. He's in the garden. He's verifying the will of the Father. He's committed to doing that will. The Father strengthens him with his word and his promises and that this is his will. And now Jesus is going to go out and he's strengthened. He's spiritually alive to God. The disciples, because they rejected Jesus' words and God's plan, became spiritually sleepers. He is spiritually alive now. He's been strengthened emotionally, strengthened physically, strengthened spiritually, strengthened mentally. And he's going to go, he's going to set his face like a flint and go to that cross. He's been strengthened. He's going to leave that cross. And the disciples, they're still sleeping over here, and they're going to wake up more exhausted than they were before, spiritually, mentally, physically, emotionally exhausted, and they're going to run. They're going to flee. And we'll see that as we go through here. So Jesus is going to obey, having been strengthened through prayer, thinking the things of God instead of the things of men, denying himself. All this is in Matthew 16, where he gives that first major, at least, announcement of his upcoming suffering, death, and resurrection. And he's going to accept the cup in obedience to the Father, Abba, Father, as an adult son in the Father's business. And he's going to carry out the Father's business. He knows that's the best way. That's the best will. That's the best plan. Peter's plan won't work. The 11's plan won't work. Satan's plan won't work. It has to be the Father's plan. And that includes the cross and drinking of the cup of wrath. And that's what he's going to do. The hour has come. Let's pick it up there in verse 46. Rise, let us be going. Behold, he is at hand that doth betray me. So the hour is at hand. Jesus is betrayed by Judas, but he is really betrayed, handed over, delivered, and Paul actually says this, over into the hands of his enemies and sinners by God and himself. He's choreographing this whole thing. He could leave at any moment he wanted. He could escape. He could leave. And we're going to see that as we go through this account. He's going to the cross. Would have been nice if he had gone with his disciples and they could have gone together. But they're going to flee and he's going to go there all alone in the hands of his enemies. And he's going to go to that cross. But God's going to raise him from the dead on the third day. Let's just read through the account here and just kind of get an overview of what's going to happen next. Verse 47, and while he yet spake, lo, Judas, one of the 12, came, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now he that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, that same as he, hold him fast. And forthwith he came to Jesus and said, Hail, Master, and kissed him. And Jesus said unto him, Friend, wherefore art thou come? Then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. And behold, one of them, which were with Jesus, stretched out his hand and drew his sword. We know from John that was Peter. And struck a servant of the high priest and smote off his ear. Then said Jesus unto him, Put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels, 72,000 angels? But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled? That's the key. That's how he was strengthened in that garden. He's going to fulfill the words of his Father, that thus it must be. In that same hour, said Jesus to the multitudes, are ye come out as against a thief with swords and staves for to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in the temple, and ye laid no hold on me. But all this was done that the scriptures, here we have it again, of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. Notice, it's not just they fled, they forsook him and fled. They, having not been strengthened through prayer in the garden, they're now going to fall into those temptations that they should have been praying about at that time. So now what I thought we'd do is I just list out some highlights from this section. And just to kind of bring it a little more to life, and just a couple points here. When we look in verse 47 about this mob, it says, "And with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and elders of the people." Remember, this is a group of people who were really afraid of trying to take Jesus during this Passover week, because remember, there's millions of Jews in Jerusalem at this time and in the area, and they were afraid, both the Romans and the leaders of Jerusalem were afraid if anything happened, it'd be really easy for a riot to occur. We actually see this at the beginning of chapter 26. Flip back a page, and we'll see this at the very beginning here. Look at verse 3. Let's look at verse 2. "Ye know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified." So he's going to go to that cross in 2 days. "Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people under the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas." The very next section, we're going to be back in the high priest's palace, Caiaphas's palace, "and consulted," verse 4, "that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people." Jesus is actually going to bring this out at the end of his words here when he talks about, "I was in the temple all day teaching, and you never touched me. Now you come out to a little hidden garden out in the dark in the middle of the night. Now you're going to come and grab me with your swords and your staves and your mob." This mob, sometimes we have the impression, you know, the Revolutionary War and stuff, and you'd kind of see these pictures, and you had shopkeepers out with their sticks or their swords or their guns or something. Well, that's not what this mob was. This mob wasn't a bunch of shopkeepers who really didn't know what they were doing in a mob. These were probably primarily temple police. They're from the temple, they're from the religious system, the leaders of the religious system, temple police, and you can be assured that the Romans weren't not observing this. So this is probably full of Roman guards and the temple police from Jerusalem, from the temple. So this is a major mob, and there's probably soldiers there. Go over to John 18:3. You can keep your hand. We'll be bouncing back a little between John 18, where we get a little more detail, than here in Matthew. John 18:3. Notice that he adds the fact where he's going on here. "Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, come thither with lanterns and torches and weapons." So these were a major. These were also included officers. These were trained militiamen. They've come to take Jesus in the middle of the night. Oops. The other thing I wanted to just point out here, back to Matthew 26. I may put a bookmark in John 18 because we'll be going back there. But in Matthew 26, notice when we have Judas betray Jesus, he says, look in verse 49 here, "And forthwith he came to Jesus and said, Hail, Master." Now, hopefully for everyone here, by the time this week during this final week of Jesus' life here, as he's going to the cross, it began with the importance of the title of Jesus. And it distinguished between those who would refer to him as, "O Lord, O Lord," and those who wouldn't. Those who refuse to address him as, "O Lord, O Lord," haven't been taught by the Father that he's the Christ, the Son of God. And they are unsaved. They could be following him. They could be, you remember at the very beginning of the week, we've talked about this over and over, so I'm just going to say very quickly so you get the picture of what Judas is demonstrating here, this unbelief that goes through the, that represents the whole nation. Jesus comes over the Jordan, he goes to Jericho. Two blind men say they're the only ones in this whole week, except for the disciples, who get it right. And they say, O Lord, thou son of David. The multitudes who were following rebuke them, and they take a big eraser, and they erase, O Lord, we'll refer to him as son of David, but we're not going to refer to him as, O Lord, they get into Jerusalem, and they misquote Psalm 118, and they erase, O Lord, and just say, thou son of David. Then it progresses to the temple, and the leaders in the temple, they have their big eraser, and they want to even erase, thou son of David. They want to completely erase him. At the Last Supper, when he was up there, and remember when Jesus exposed the betrayer, one of us is going to be betrayed. And what did the all of them except Judas say? They all said, Lord, is it I? What did Judas say? Judas said, Master, is it I? The difference between a believer and an unbeliever at this time was those who had believed the gospel of the kingdom, God counted their faith for righteousness, justified unto eternal life, and then the first thing he did was teach them himself that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And they would address him as, O Lord. And we read in Matthew, where at Peter's confession there, Jesus says, don't tell anyone. Why can't you tell this? Well, in the very verse before that, he told them, why you're not to tell anyone this is because this can only be taught by the Father. He teaches the true believers, Jesus is Christ, the Son of the living God. He is the Lord. Anyone else who denies that, they're not a part of it. They're not, haven't been taught of the Father. They're not saved. That's the main distinguishing thing in this last week. Those who would refer to him as the Lord and those who wouldn't refer to him as the Lord. And there you have. He said, talked earlier in Matthew about driving the wedge. Well, there's one of those wedges. All right. So that's, I think, an important thing to say. Judas is continuing in his rebellion against God. And rejection of God and his name. The other thing I just want to point out here is that no one takes Jesus. Jesus is not just taken. Jesus surrenders. Jesus surrenders. Let's look at that. Go up to verse. Let's pick it up at verse 53. Verse 53, thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? See, no one's taking Jesus. He says here, I could pray to the Father, and he'd send 72,000 angels. I don't think the mob would be any competition for that. And we'll see something else over in John 18. But I don't know if it's a direct comparison or not. But remember, there was an angel of the Lord when the Assyrians were attacking the city of Jerusalem. And they were all camped on the other side of the wall. There was an angel of the Lord. Now, that angel of the Lord was probably the Lord himself. But what did he hit? How many men did he kill of the Roman or the Assyrian army? He destroyed 185,000 men in one night. Now, that may have been the Lord himself, but it gives you the idea. These angels that he could have called down could have more than taken over the mob, could have more than taken over the temple police, could have more than wiped out the Roman army. He could have called down them, but he didn't. And he tells you why, the very next verse. But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled? The Father's words won't be fulfilled that way. Go over to John 18. We see another example of this. John 18. Look at verse 5. John 18, verse 5. We're in the same scene here. They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. So they're asking, who are you looking for? It's Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said unto them, I am he. He surrenders. He gives it to him. He doesn't try to leave. You remember there are other times in the gospel accounts where he's got a mob coming after him and he just kind of disappears somehow. He just, all of a sudden he's on, or sometimes he's on the other side of the lake, or he just moved. He could have done that here. But then how would the scriptures be fulfilled? Of course, the answer is they couldn't be. And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with him. And soon then, as he had said unto them, I am he, look what happened. They went backward and fell to the ground. And he's going to say, and I get a little humorous if you look at it this way, in a very unhumorous account, but a little bit of humor in here. Here he says, I am, and hopefully all of you know that that is the Lord. The Lord's name, his Jehovah name, the Lord of the Old Testament. He's claiming to be the Lord Jehovah God. I am. And just saying that word blew all those soldiers, the temple police, the mob, and they fell backwards. Nobody's taking Jesus. He's going to say it again, I am again. And I don't think it says it explicitly there, but I'm imagining this crowd of people, they just stand up. He says, I am again, and they all get blown back down again. There's nobody taking Jesus. This is all part of the Father's plan. He's going to go to that cross. He's got to go to that cross. Otherwise, how will the scriptures be fulfilled? How will God's plan and purpose and business be carried out? Let's just read a couple more verses while we're here. Look at verse 7. Then asked he them again, whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus answered, I have told you, I am he. Now I imagine in my own mind, they all fell back again on the ground. If therefore ye seek me, let these go their own way. And that's going to bring us to another point here, is even in the midst of what's going on, he's still the good shepherd. He's still, in spite of the disciples' denial of him, he's still protecting his sheep. Look what he says here. He says, Jesus answered, I have told you that I am he. If therefore ye seek me, let these go their way. He's still the good shepherd. He's still protecting the sheep. He's still providing for that. And of course, they are going to go their own way, and they're going to forsake him, go farther than that, and forsake and flee him. All right, back to Matthew 26. The other thing I just wanted to bring out is failing to carry out their own plans by the sword. We saw Peter just trying to do that there. With Jesus' surrender, where Jesus is savoring the things of God, they were savoring the things of men, and their plan was falling apart, and they were despairing and defeated. Jesus' plan, having prayed and been strengthened by the Father, knew it was the will of the Father, the things of the Father, and he was strengthened, savoring the things of God. This shattered everything for them. And all the disciples at the end of verse 56, then all the disciples forsook him and fled. And so that's where we're going to end up there as we go now into the next section. And Jesus has now exposed the hypocrisy of this vain religious system. I was in the temple every day. Why didn't you take me there? They're hypocrites. They're afraid of the people. We just read that at the beginning of Matthew 26. They're afraid of the people. They're hypocrites. They're just the vain religious system. And that's he's going to go now to that cross. I think it's important to remember this disciples' reaction and what happens when you replace God's things with your own things, or the things of men, or the things of the world. Here you have an interdispensational truth, not the specifics of this account, but any time you're despairing, any time you're defeated, it means you're savoring the things of men rather than the things of God. When you savor in our program, for this is true in our program, the dispensation of grace or the mystery program for the body of Christ, when your focus is on God and His things, when you're savoring His things, when His things are His things are the most important things to you, what's important to Him is important to you, what He values is you're valuing, it always, Romans 8, it always results in being full of hope and victory. And that's a big lesson we can learn. If you're despairing or you're defeated, it's because you're savoring the things of men rather than the things of God. Just as true today as it was for these disciples back then. Anytime you replace God's things with your own things, your things are going to fall apart. Let me just give you a heads up, advance warning. The only things that are going to last forever are God's things. And being in line with that is always full of hope and always ends in victory. And this cross is going to be full of hope and end in victory through that resurrection from the dead. Having said that, everything wasn't completely forsaken. We do have a couple disciples who did kind of try to follow the Lord, and we're going to see them as we go through the next passage here, but I thought we'd bring them up since we've been a little hard on the disciples. There were a couple who followed from a distance, I guess you could say. They all fled, they all forsook him, but the Apostle John, probably, it says in the account of John, he talks about the disciple Jesus loved. He goes and follows Jesus all the way into the palace of the high priest. You learn in John, I think it is, that he knew the high priest and so had access to that. So he goes all the way in there. Peter followed from afar, but he went as far as the palace too, and John got him into the courtyard of the palace. So they did have this at least attempt to go and follow him. So we have to give them credit for there. They are not acting as cowards in any sense. They are acting as those suffering the consequences of replacing God's will with their own will. And their own will was falling apart. They were despairing and defeated. And he says, Peter's going to say here as we go through here, I guess we could just look over verse 58 in Matthew 26. He says, but Peter followed after him off unto the priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants to see the end. See, for him, it was an end. For him, everything was falling apart. For him, everything was despair and defeat. For him, everything was coming to a ruin. For him, in his view, all of Jesus' ministry and all those things that he talked about, the kingdom, is all coming to nothing because he refused Jesus' words about that cross and being raised from the dead 3 days later. So he's going to go there. So we'll give him some credit there. Let's go over and look at John 18. It's important, I think I forgot to mention, but the note mentions here, we also see John again at the foot of the cross. So he almost does what the 11 should have done. They should have gone with him through this whole thing. And they should have all been at the foot of that cross. And he, so he could go through this with his friends, with his disciples. Instead, he's going to be all alone, and he's going to even be forsaken of God. Not only forsaken of the disciples, but forsaken of God on that cross. So let's go to John 18 again. John 18, verse 16. And here we get a little more information. I guess verse 15, and Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. that disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. So that's what we think is John, the Apostle John. Verse 16, but Peter stood at the door without, then went out that other disciple, which was known unto the high priest, and spoke unto her that kept the door and brought Peter in. And later we'll learn she brought him into the courtyard. And so that's where we go from there. But now let's go back to Matthew 26. And we'll just kind of go through some of these additional details. Jesus is going to complete surrenders, and it completes the disciples' despair and defeat. Having lost the opportunity to be strengthened through prayer, they flee and forsake him. And now we're going to go into these denials and trials. And just to, if we kind of look and break this up, we're going to see that these trials, they're not, you know, some of them probably aren't technically trials. They're just kind of, especially these that are going to happen in the middle of the night, they're probably just kind of thrown together groups of people that are getting the information they need when he goes to the real trial before Pilate. But we're going to call them trials just for simplicity's sake. And so he's got these illegal trials, and that goes from chapter 26 all the way just into chapter 27, the illegal trials before the Jewish council. And that's encapsulated. That's kind of in a bracket. And it's going to be encapsulated in Peter going into the courtyard of the priest and Peter coming out of the courtyard of the priest. Let's just look at that. Look at verse 58 here. We read this earlier where Peter followed him after afar off unto the priest's palace and went in and sat down with the servants to see the end. And then if you go over to the end of all this in verse 26, verse 75, the last verse of the chapter, Matthew 26, verse 75, this basic account's going to end. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus, which was said unto him, before the cock crow, and shalt deny me thrice. And he went out now of the courtyard and wept bitterly. So we have this whole account. It begins really with Peter going into the courtyard. He's going to watch the end, see how this all falls out. Everything's coming to shambles in his view. Of course, in Jesus's view, everything's coming to fulfillment. But in his view, it isn't. He's going to see the end, watch everything fall apart. It's going to begin and end with his entry into the courtyard of the high priest and as he exits that with his denials. Then in the next section, chapter 27, 2 to 26, begins with Jesus being handed over to Pilate, and it ends with Pilate handing him over to be put to death, to go to that cross. So here we have our map. We'll come back to that. Let's just go on and look at a couple others. I'm just kind of give a general flavor for what's in store. Here you're also going to have in this next section two dramatic downfalls of Jesus' disciples. One is going to be Peter, of course. You're going to have his three denials. And then this next one is going to be Judas's confession and attempt to rid himself of guilt, and he's going to throw the money back at the vain religious system, and he's going to try to alleviate guilt. So you have the major downfall of two of Jesus' disciples. And then we're going to see what is going to develop as we go through here is you're going to have the ever-increasing, and I guess you'd have to call it ironic because they certainly don't mean it, the ironic, ever-increasing presentation of who Jesus is. And it's going to come out of the mouths. It should have come out of the mouths of the religious system. Instead, now it's going to come out of the mouths of his enemies and people putting him to death. Just let's get a flavor for that. Go to chapter 26, verse 63. Here he's before Caiaphas, and we'll go into more of the details of this next week. Here he's before Caiaphas. Caiaphas is getting mad because he's not talking. And verse 63, Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. So he's going to adjure him by the living God. And of course, remember when Peter gave his confession, it was the Son of the living God. Now Jesus answers. He's not going to defend himself from these false witnesses just before this, but now that he adjures to the living God, he's going to answer. And Jesus said unto him, he's going to up the ante. Jesus says unto him, "Thou hast said." So it's his way of saying, "Yes, I'm claiming that. I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. And you've said it. You've got it right. I am." But then that wasn't bad enough from a blasphemy standpoint. That's going to give some of the reasons for blasphemy they're going to accuse him of here, claiming to be God, the Son of God. Then he's going to go on and up the ante. The rest of verse 64. "Nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." So now he ups the ante and he ups that Son of Man, that end time Son of Man from Daniel 7, who comes, going to return with the power and the glory and the clouds of heaven. I would suspect that's the angelic armies of heaven, and they're going to come and he's going to restore his glory on earth. He's going to wipe out all the kingdoms on earth and establish his own kingdom. And Jesus claiming to be that too. So he's claiming to be that end time Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power in accord with Daniel's prophecy. That's in Daniel 7. And then at when they put the placard on the cross, so we have Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We have Jesus, the Son of Man, sitting at the right hand of power according to Daniel's prophecy with regard to the kingdom being set up on earth. And then look at chapter 27, verse 11. Chapter 7, verse 27, verse 11. "And Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, Art thou the King of the Jews? And Jesus said unto him, Thou sayest." So now we've gone from Caiaphas. He acknowledged he's the Christ, the Son of God. He's not only that, he's the Son of God that Daniel talked about. He's going to come back in power and glory, and he's the King of the Jews. And of course, we see this again on the placard at his cross. But there's, go to verse 29. Verse 29, they also mock him with this. "And when they had platted the crown of thorns," this is chapter 27, verse 29, "and put it upon his head, and a reed in his hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews." They mock him. It goes all throughout here. But they're basically what they're saying, they're acknowledging who he is. And of course, you get even a Roman guard at the cross that recognizes him as the Son of God. So you have this ever-increasing revelation of who Jesus really was. Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, the King of the Jews.